Good morning, everybody. It's great to see you. Thanks so much for coming out on this beautiful Sunday morning. We are in the midst of our series with the uplifting title, Advent, Hope in a Weary World. I was being a little sarcastic there. It's not exactly uplifting. But last week was really exciting because we had special guests who talked about Taizé, and it was just a wonderful experience. We did a lot of great singing with Francis doing some of the leading for us. Oh, your voice is beautiful. So today we are very excited to introduce Kimmy Bowe. Kimmy Bowe is going to be talking about redefining work from the perspective of an artist's mother, and we're so looking forward to hearing her speak today. And we are very grateful that she's able to give some of her time to us. I'm going to introduce her in a moment, but first, let's pray. Please pray with me. Creator God, thank you for your amazing grace. Thank you for Kimmy Bowe and her willingness to share her gifts with us. We ask that you bless this time we have together so that we may learn and grow. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Kimmy Bowe is currently an artist in residence at Overseas Ministries Study Center at Princeton Theological Seminary. Kimmy Bowe's art engages with concepts arising from life as an immigrant and caregiver in the form of ink drawings, prints, artists' books, and collaborative practices. Like a Mike Carrizal network, the themes of transition, growth, ambivalence, resilience, and hope form its subterranean network of roots from which seedlings sprout for new work. Her work will be on display here next door in the conference room at the end of March and through April. Please give a warm welcome for Kimmy Bowe.
Yeah, I would like to thank everyone for your presence. And I would like to thank the church, Nassau Presbyterian Church, for inviting me on the second week of Advent. And especially I want to thank Glenn for organizing all the details for this event. And Kim and Noel were not here, but I would like to thank them for supporting me to do this talk. So when I was pregnant with my first child, Connie, my college friend, asked me, "Bo, is your art going to change when you become a mother?" This question pulled me back to the day when, as an undergraduate, I was participating in a group critique in a graduate seminar. One female MFA student in her 30s presented her work, and a male professor in his 70s was giving a comment. The artwork was a collage of the artist's baby scribbles on paper. It was a collaboration between the artist and the baby. I don't remember the exact wording, but professor, in essence, said the work doesn't have any point. What I remember vividly was the tension in the room as the artist was holding back her tears, and I was feeling embarrassed for her. As a 20-year-old woman with no experience with babies, I also could not see what the artist saw in the scribbles of a child. The lesson I took from this experience was that women shouldn't make art with her baby things in it. So I answered to Connie's question, "No, I don't think so. I don't think my child will change my art." 14 years later, here I am giving a talk about how mothering has shaped my work as an artist. Isn't life full of irony? Catherine Ricketts, in her recent book, The Mother Artist, talks about why it is important for artists who are mothers to continue making art despite the daily challenges and lack of support. Here is an excerpt from her book in the chapter Vision, Seeing Like a Mother. When members of the art establishment say that motherhood is not a serious subject, they imply that maternal perspective is only meaningful to mothers. These artists whose work is presented in this chapter of the book demonstrate that the maternal attention enriches artistic vision and lavishes upon all who engage with their work the gift of humanized gaze. This is not to say that those without children can't make work that humanizes. It is simply to emphasize what's lost when mothers who rehearse habits of care and parenting abandon their other ambitions. Culture is shaped by the work we make, whether a mother is making art or making laws or making diagnoses, designing buildings or designing a software, tending a farm or tending bar. Our world needs her unique vision, changed in caregiving. I can share numerous ways in which the experience of motherhood has shaped how I am making art. But today I want to focus on just one topic, which is work. So it comes the title of the presentation, Redefining Work from the Perspective of an Artist Mother. My experience of mothering set me on the path of unlearning and reformulating the idea of work and success. Through the help of other women's writings, I learned to think critically and not taking things as it is. Double exile in motherhood in a foreign country, living on the thin line between two worlds, not completely belonging anywhere, through a crack that gets opened, she falls into Nepantla, grows a new sensory organ, sees the world again. Nepantla is a Nahuatl word meaning in between spaces, a term adopted by Gloria Anzaldúa, the author who wrote extensively on the theories of the borderland identity and borderland thinking. In her writing, Nepantla indicates a liminal space, times of great confusion, anxiety, and loss of control, which can also be a place from which holistic and relational concepts to understand our worlds in plural can emerge. The year when I was pregnant with my first child, Love, was the most productive time in terms of my artistic career. I had graduated from MFA in printmaking in Seoul, had moved back to the US in Minneapolis with my husband, and got a shared studio and had worked as a full-time artist for 2 years. I was invited to two major exhibitions, had received the state-funded grant to create a mosaic mural in a high school. While I was 6 months pregnant, I had a solo show, worked on the mosaic mural until I gave birth in September. For the next 12 months, I stayed home with a newborn, healing, nursing, grocery shopping, cooking, cleaning, visiting doctors, attending parenting classes. Then my husband agreed to take a semester of leave from his studies so I can go back to work. I worked again as a part-time artist until my second child, Hope, was born. Seen or unseen, mothering work is generative. I keep track of 3 or 4 ongoing to-do lists scattered in different parts of the brain. I'm constantly talking with other human beings while setting a dinner on the table. I take care of plants in the balcony. I try to do morning stretch or quiet time before someone wakes up. When a child is peacefully nursing on my breast, I read parenting books or other essays on various topics to keep my brain busy, or search other opportunities or residencies and exhibitions. But there is one thing I didn't do well enough during these early years of motherhood, and it was resting. Even so, with a tired mind and body, at the end of the day, I would often feel like I'm not productive enough. And I would even doubt my value as a person. Why? Fast forward, after my husband's study was finished in Minneapolis, we would enter a period of uncertainty that would last 3 years, which is marked with packing, unpacking, repacking, moving across the Pacific and back, and then arrival of my third child, Faith, moving across the Atlantic and learning a new language and encountering new possibilities. It was 2016 in Geneva, Switzerland. I had a great opportunity to work again as an artist in residency at a shared printmaking studio, Atelier Genevois de Gravure Contemporain. But there were some challenges that I had to face as a working artist and a mother. Aside from the financial and time-related challenges that most artist mothers face day to day, what made these hardships even heavier was the fact that I moved to a new country where I didn't know anyone. Unlike the popular image of an artist where she's working alone in a studio, artists, in fact, operate as business people, or should, meaning we need to meet other professionals and collaborate with institutions. Mothers of young children are at a disadvantage because most art events where you can meet people happen in the evenings or weekends when children need their parents the most. In my case, the cultural and language barrier added psychological and social block that got in the way of bringing my art to the public. Around this time, I was working on a series called Kitchen Math. I started drawing the things found in the kitchen, like an egg beater, utensils, knives, a can opener, a cheese grater, wine bottle stopper, among others, and later turned these into repeating pattern. I wanted a visual translation of my work and time spent doing domestic work, starting from the kitchen. I love making repeat patterns. I play with different permutations of repeating the base unit until I find the one that pleases me. This process is not so different from doing jigsaw puzzles. I also love the process of etching on the copper plate, polishing the plate to a mirror-like surface, degreasing the plate, and applying the liquid ground, scratching the hardened ground, submerging the plate in the acid bath, reworking the plate, etching some more, taking off the ground, and finally pulling a test print and see the image for the first time. The precise steps I need to follow help me to stay focused and forget the pressure of making something good. Of course, it is not always just fun, and there are frustrations and disappointment involved in the creating process. As anyone who makes things knows, ruining and failing are just part of the process. But for me, this is not the hardest part. The scariest piece I must wrestle with in my art making is self-doubt. Self-doubt can come in different forms. For example, it can attack my artwork, pointing at the flaws and comparing it to other artists' work, saying mine is not good enough. In other times, it makes moral judgments, calling the artist irresponsible, self-absorbed, too idealistic. Around the time when I was making Kitchen Math series, I started seriously doubting the purpose of my work as an artist. First and foremost, I thought it didn't make any financial sense. Even though my residency provided a free access to use a printmaking studio, of which I was very grateful for, I had to pay for childcare to free my time for art making. I was feeling guilty of spending family income for childcare to continue my work when I didn't have immediate earning from my work. Not having a gallery or a strong online platform, I didn't have much confidence that I was able to sell the artworks I was making. On the other hand, my husband never doubts to this day that one day I will become famous and that we will live off my art after his retirement. I was very grateful for his support, but nonetheless, I still felt irresponsible for making negative income. To help myself to process this uneasiness in my conscience, I produced these two documents you can see on the screen. In the first document, I compared the total input and output of producing Kitchen Math series. The left column is input, which lists the calculation of total time, wage, and the materials. The right column shows output in two categories, the materialistic and non-materialistic. You can see in the first section under input, I counted the hours spent in the studio, which was easy to keep track of because I could only work when children are at some kind of daycare or a babysitter. I put 25 Swiss francs per hour as my wage, which was 5 francs more than minimum wage in Switzerland. Then in the third section, I calculated babysitter salary. I didn't add in the tuition of preschool because I figured even if I didn't work as in my art, I will still send my children to preschool. And lastly, I added the cost of the materials. So it comes out to be almost 10,000, basically, 9,598. On the right column, you can see under the materialistic output, 30 pieces of artwork, of which 12 will be exhibited. Under the non-materialistic output, I wrote value of maintaining artist's mental health, the pleasure derived from the process of production, the value of experience created through the exhibition, including the experience of the potential viewers. Then I thought the left column should also have non-materialistic input to make it even. That's why I made the second document on the right, which talks about the inputs that are difficult to measure. Here belongs the work of research and accumulating related experiences around the theme of the artwork, which in this case of kitchen mat was domestic work. So I listed some of the activities that I consider as domestic work. The list includes not only the typical housework, but also the activities that would be considered normally as leisure, including listening to podcasts about parenting, making new friends, getting out to nature with children to teach them about seasons, and praying for my family members. So I exhibited this series along with the two documents at the group exhibition of Artists in Residency in 2017. At that time, I didn't know that I would exhibit the series again in Basel in 2018 and again in Geneva in 2019. And it would sell 4 prints, and one of them would help to raise funding for independently curated exhibition in Basel. So a total of 960 francs should be added in the should be added. Then it comes out then it's a 10% of the input. The output is a 10%. So if you just compare the monetary value, it doesn't make sense. During the kitchen math, I came to understand that both my work as an artist and my work as a mother is not considered real work. Therefore, undervalued and rendered invisible within the framework of the market economy. And over time, I came to observe how this had a negative effect on how I value my own work. It prompted me to redefine my work as an artist. So work equals play equal care. So from 2017 onwards, on my website, this is a screenshot of my website, I use work is play is care in place of just work. So when people want to find my artistic production, they need to click on this button, work equal play equal care. One concept I want to get into to explain this equation is the idea of reproductive work, some of you may be familiar with. It is an economical term for the activities and labor necessary for the maintenance and reproduction of human life and society. It includes childbearing, caring for children, the elderly, the sick, people with disabilities, and the domestic labor, such as cooking, cleaning, etc., and the emotional labor that includes teaching values, managing relationships, nurturing a particular culture, among others. In recent years, care work as a term is replacing reproductive work to emphasize the emotional dimension of such tasks. I am using two terms interchangeably in this context. Most of care work done for family members or close friends is unpaid work. Therefore, it's exempt from the economic measurements like GDP. In our society where work and economy are considered, we are mostly talking about production of goods and services and consumption. Our concept of production is so deeply rooted in earning capacity that we only call it real work when the labor results in money. Hence, a lot of full-time mothers say they don't work. As a stay-at-home mom myself, I even catch myself asking other mom questions like, do you work? This just tells me how I have internalized this notion of work equals money. This is why I was feeling guilty about spending money on childcare to go make art, which doesn't result in financial gain. With this value, within this value system of work is money is value, how do we value the work we do for caring for our children, aging parents, family members with disability, and culture? I once attended a talk in Basel by a Swiss economist, Masha Majorin. Her study emphasizes the critical economic value of unpaid care labor, advocating for its recognition and integration into macroeconomic frameworks. This one first. Okay. In this first table, sorry, it's a bit small, but I can explain. In the first table, she shows a volume of unpaid care work conducted within 1 year in Switzerland in terms of the hours spent. The second table shows the volume of paid care work in terms of hours. She finds out that most work is done in the unpaid sector than the paid care work. You can also find here information of how care is distributed between men and women. Yeah, so total hours of unpaid care work, 8,235. In the paid care work, 7,508. I mean, so it is a bit more in the unpaid sector. And in this third table, she calculated the gross value of unpaid work based on the labor cost of comparable jobs and came up with this table of extended GDP and gross value added by institutional sector. So you can see that monetized value of unpaid work in hypothetically would be 408,691,000,000 Swiss franc, which is greater than the gross income in any of other sectors, even banks. So even if it's only theoretical, Majorin's study proves the value of unpaid care labor, making visible the vast amount of invisible work carried out daily by men and women. Although much greater, she shows much greater work in this sector is done more by women than men, but this is not the concern of this presentation. Now I wonder, what would it look like if an economist applies this methodology to the activities related to art making, collecting the data of time spent in making and translating it into monetary value? Maybe it will give us tremendous hope when we see how much work artists are doing in our society. It can also be used to prove that art making is a real job. Many governments, with few exceptions, do not perceive an artistic activity as real work unless the artist is generating income from it. When I was in Switzerland, I couldn't get a place in a public daycare because I was not working from the government's perspective, not having an employer nor enough income from self-employment. Most artists, regardless of how successful, voluntarily use many hours of unpaid work to hone their skills, accumulate experiences, read, listen, and watch other artists work to stay up to date. Artists may eventually get paid commissions, grants, or get invited for residencies, sell artworks, or earn salaries for teaching art, but it often takes a few years before any of these happen. So, as an artist and a mother of preschool-age children, I was working a double shift of unpaid labor. This is not so uncommon among other artist mothers whom I have acquainted on online communities. Each artist must find her own way to navigate her family duties and artistic commitments, maximizing the available resources. Paying for extra childcare was the best solution during these 4 months when I was making kitchen mat. And other times, I was mostly making art at home, drawing, writing, or just thinking about what I want to make. These early days of motherhood for artists can be lonely and exhausting. She may feel excluded from any professional world and even other social groups. Gloria Anzaldúa's theory of borderline thinking that I mentioned earlier can speak into this situation. When strongly held beliefs are shattered and conventional ways of thinking can no longer explain one's reality, one can turn this into an opportunity to develop new perspectives and imagine a different reality. In my case, the experience of working as an artist and a mother opened up a crack through which I saw the imperfections in the conventional narrative of work and success, which I held onto since my childhood. If there is one new perspective that I have gained from this experience, is that our value as a person does not depend on our productivity, and the value of our work does not depend on the profit it generates. This new way of thinking frees me from feeling guilty or unworthy. I realize, before hoping that someone else will value my work, I can start valuing my own work. My friend Nicole, who is a firm believer of the well-known aphorism, "Your mindset is everything," challenges me to take some time to do something I like besides working in the studio and taking care of my children. Maybe I can start by recognizing that I have worked hard enough for the day. I wonder if this reflection can be extended to other institutional sectors in our society. If more workers find a daily dose of pleasure in their workplace and treat work as an extension of relationships, how would our society change? I leave you with this question, and I would like to show you more images from this kitchen mat series. So this is a place where I worked, Atelier Genevois de Gravure Contemporain in Geneva. It's a beautiful studio. These are the prints. Yeah, so thank you for staying with me for this. And I would like to now take this opportunity to share my other work that's not related to kitchen mat for the remainder of time. And it's another piece from my work, is Play is Care. It's titled Boundlessly. So it's this artist book that I printed 100 copies using Rizzo printmaking, Rizzo printing. And so for this, I did a crowdfunding. And in 2018, so I did a crowdfunding. And mostly my friends, family supported this. And then, it's actually my first time actually reading some of the poems from this book. So there are 6 drawings in this book, and 2 of them are interpretations of the works of Edvard Munch. And the first one is this one. It's actually, that image is a painting called The Sick Child. You may know the original one. That's my interpretation. And it looks like this. This is a short one, so I won't read this one. I'll read the next one. This image is from another work from Munch, and here is a poem. "Put the power back to the body it belongs." A Norwegian male painter named Edvard Munch painted his sister, Laura Catherine Munch, and called it Melancholia, supposedly. There are several versions of this composition that the artist produced in different periods of his life. My personal favorites are the painting of 1911 and a lithography made in 1930. I am interested in Laura's gaze. Is it possible that she is there and not there at the same time? Can she exist in both places at once? I see in this painting a mother regrouping herself, taking in the energy of light, so she can be a loving presence again. Another drawing and a poem. And this one is called Sometimes the Sinking of Mood. Sometimes the sinking of mood comes from a small crack. The long hand of a clock moving too slowly. The same branches on a winter tree seen from the window. Too many sips of coffee and too few hours of sleep. Miscoordinated muscles around his lips. Overuse of dissonance in the background music. Tongue gliding over a hole where a tooth used to be. Painting untouched, ideas too many. This is another poem. And there goes this page. And the last one. I summon my spat out words. Mother duck said, quack, 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 quack. And all five little ducks came back from Five Little Ducks nursery rhyme. I too summoned, and all five spat out words came back, worthless, overwhelmed, vengeful, envious, and alienated. Sat by my side, by my feet, so I picked each one up and laid them on my lap, singing, I see you with my winter tree eyes, perch on my arms where you'll be safe. Hungry tigers went to sleep. Let the tears fall in the evening. Your story is told. I have seen where your feet meet water. Let those who are buried nourish my tree roots. Alas, you and I will make songs again. Thank you.
Thank you, Kimmy Bo. We have time for some questions. Does anyone have any questions?
I have a comment. Okay. When I was younger, and I was married, I had a husband unlike yours who thought if I were not bringing in money, then I was not contributing, even though I had three little kids. So first of all, kudos to your husband. And I hope today that women are more aware of what I was not aware of. I also have three daughters who are grown and are parents, and I tell them as often as I can, motherhood is the hardest job you will ever do, and you are the best. So I'm trying to make up for what I didn't, with the messages that I did not get growing up. Mm-hmm. So I, your message is strong and beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bo. I related to so much of what you had to say. I am a childless musician. I did not have children, and I was actually relieved. And I wanted to mention that I had a grandmother. My parents were not musical, but my grandmother was. Around the turn of the 20th century, she had a degree in music. She sang, she played the piano, but I never, ever saw her make any music at all. Excuse me. And I asked her about it, and she said, well, you know, I had my boys. She had five sons, and that was a message. Mm. And growing up with my mother, she talked all the time about wonderful adventures when she was a young woman teaching school. And all her stories were about that or before. And somehow I got the message that life stopped when you had children. And I felt fear that if I had children, my music would not continue, that I would not have the energy or the creativity to put in it. And so I related to a lot of what you... I had a supportive husband, but I that's just the way I felt. So it was very interesting hearing your story, and I do hope things are changing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. First of all, I'd love to say that your work is just beautiful. Mm. I don't see that well from a distance, but it just is very lovely, and the presentation that you gave at the end with the poetry was just really moving. Mm-hmm. Frances, I had three, and I'm a musician, and I had three children, and I just had a couple things I'd like to say. First of all, I'd like to throw out to everybody that there's a wonderful book called Not for Profit that was written by Martha Nussbaum, who's at University of Chicago. She's sort of she works in the law school and also in the philosophy department. Her thesis in the book is that too much of Western civilization in particular is tied to people having value according to how much money they make, which is mm-hmm. exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And she does this wonderful thesis about how that becomes a problem in society, and it becomes a threat to democracy. Mm. That as artists, you know, we have to understand that part of what we do is expanding other people's understanding of other people. So we're trying to bring a lot of people into the room or into the gallery or whatever. We're bringing people into the room to make music who are different from each other. So an artist's role is bringing in a different view so that people are looking at things in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. And so a couple things that I was really thinking about while you were talking was, first of all, that's a definition of art. You know, Da Vinci looked at water and thought, wow, the movement of water looks like hair. And so what you're trying to do is look at things and find the similarities and bring them together. And that's that sort of empathy or connection that we have with each other, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was one thing about it. But the other thing is just taking from the empathy of just the connection that you have. Somebody else, you are not that person. Somebody else has a different life, a different view, and whatever. And it's art that brings us a common view. Mm-hmm. So the last thing I want to say is just theologically, that view of a person's value being tied to how much money they make is not very Christ-like. Hmm. So, okay, that was my sermon today. Wow.
Yes, we have another question here.
Could you talk a little bit about what you do now at the Overseas Ministry Center and like what it means to be an artist in residence?
Mm-hmm. I'm just so grateful for this opportunity this year that I even had time to read, even for this preparing this, I was so grateful that I could look back and write down what I've learned from this kitchen math. That's one thing I'm doing. And another, the new work I'm creating is actually inspired by Book of Hours from medieval European Catholic culture. I'm looking at the Hours of Virgin, as again, from mother's perspective, it's really interesting to see all these images of women in the sacred text, sacred book. So coming from Protestant background, I realize I don't know much about Mary. So I'm making my own interpretation. I'm not trying to find out all the theology behind Mary now, but I'm interested in the images that there is this, wow, there are women, this sacred text from old time. So I'm inspired by them. I'm making my own inspired drawings from it. So hopefully I'll be able to show them in March. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Thank you for your presentation. Clearly your talent lies in words, images in words, poetry, and in drawings and illustrations, and in being a wife and a mother. That's all art forms. What caught my eye, though, I'm a numbers person. I measure anything. And I data analysis. I will count dollars and cents or raindrops on a window pane. And what caught my eye was your tables of math and so on. I've often wondered if all of my measurements actually get in the way of what I'm trying to accomplish with those measurements. Until I thought, you know, that in and of itself is an art form. Have you ever thought that maybe your math and your data tables and the undergirdings of kitchen math is in and of itself a form of art?
That's really interesting because when I was in high school, I was very good at math and science. So I'm sure it's informing my work. And I also, even in my art making, I'm very precise. I like having, that's probably why I like patterns. I never thought of using data as art form, like the tables, but it's just the way of mathematical thinking definitely is informing my art and the process. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Marshall. Thank you so much for being here and sharing with us. I was trying to formulate a question, but I think I just have a comment, actually. You talk about bringing forth love and hope and faith, and I just appreciate so much how you have shown that as a process, especially as we are in this season of Advent. So thank you for helping give an example of how we can enter this season as a process that's ongoing with creativity and community.
Thank you.
Let's give another. Oh, yes, we have one more. One more question.
A couple of questions, if you're willing, about your kids. One, I wonder, what do they say about your art? And number two, perhaps, well, in no particular order, what are your hopes for the kind of world you would hope for your kids, given your reflections on this experience of work and value and life?
So my children, this morning I asked them, they were hearing some parts of the presentation as I was reading. For you, when I say I'm going to work, you take it seriously because that's all. And they say, yeah, because you were always doing it. So I said, when your dad says he's going to work, or I go to work, do you differentiate it? I asked this question. And they said, no, we take it both very seriously, you know, because I say very seriously, I'm going to work, so I can't pick you up today, or something like this. So they never doubted it, because they grew up with this. So I'm very grateful for that. I think about, as all moms do, we think about what future we want to give to children. And it is really difficult, I think, to cope with, in between realities, right? We want to imagine something better, but at the same time, we want them to survive in this world. So it's a constant battle. Even I have to always check what my values are and why I am doing this, why I want my children to do this. At the same time, I want to make sure that they can also live in this world. So I try not to be too radical with my children's education. And I want them to find their own way. I also find children often do opposite things, right? So, so I just let them find. I try to just let them find their own way. Yeah.
Let's give another big hand for Kimmy Bow. Thank you so much. And I just want to give a quick shout out to Len and Andrew Scales, who last week stepped in at the last minute. Thank you, Len, and big thanks to Andrew. Please pass his thanks on to us. Well, we'll have Dr. Heath Carter with us sometime, hopefully in the near future. We'll keep you posted on that. Next week, We are very pleased to once again welcome Maria Lobiondo, who will give an oral interpretation of Tolstoy's Two Old Men, Where Are You on Life's Pilgrimage? We hope you'll join us. Thank you.